So I recently taught a class here through Marin Sangha on the five aggregates. So I'm going to be doing a little bit of a summation of some of that and going over some of that again. So those of you who were there may have an, I wish I could get something different. But those of you who weren't but who wanted to be there, well, maybe you got lucky. So first off, it's one of the lists that the Buddha talked about. He had many different lists that he spoke of. It's a useful list. It's not generally a beginner's list. So one thing that I'd like to encourage is the attitude with which you listen to it. And I had a Dharma friend call me and leave me a voicemail after we'd both been on a long retreat together, and we'd spent some time towards the end of the retreat talking, and she sent this to me, and it was a wonderful thing to have on my voicemail, and I left it on there. You know, you had to listen to it every 26 days or 41 days or something like that to keep it active, and I kept it on there for a couple of years before I passed off into the ether. And it was something like, it was from Thich Nhat Hanh speaking about the Abhidharma, and he said that do not try to strain to understand these things. Just let them soak into you the way the rain falls onto the earth. Some of it soaks in and some of it runs off. Your job is not to hold all of the water, but just to let it soak into you, and over time it will have some impact for you, hopefully. So what are the five aggregates and why do they matter? Well, first off, what is an aggregate? What the heck is that? A little convoluted word. The word in Pali, which was the language in which the teachings were first written down, is khanda, which generally is translated as heap or bundle or pile. You know, if you were doing your raking, you would have a khanda of leaves, or somebody who was gathering sticks to take them to the market, that would be a khanda of sticks, a bundle. So just some kind of grouping, a way to group things together. And it's the Pali word. The Buddha's first teaching was on the Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth was the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And those are broken up into three kind of groupings, right? There's the sila or ethical conduct grouping, and the samadhi or concentration grouping, and then there's the panya or wisdom grouping. And if you look in Pali, it's the sila khanda, the samadhi khanda, and the panya khanda. So this word khanda really just means a grouping, a way of bringing things together. Andrea Fella, one of the teachers at Spirit Rock, talks about how the word aggregate actually is not that bad a word. It's both a noun and a verb. The noun, she defines, I love this definition, stuff made of other stuff. Keep that in mind, because these aggregates are important. Stuff made of other stuff. And then the verb to aggregate is to pull things together. We take these different aggregates, these different five aggregates, and they're stuff made of other stuff, and we use them and weave them together and create this tangled knot of this me that keeps tumbling on. And the me with all of the dukkha, all of the unsatisfactoriness, the unpleasantness, the suffering that can come with that, the pain, the mental pain, the physical pain. Yeah. So the Buddha taught that experience has three characteristics. that all experience was anicca or impermanent. All conditioned things were anicca or impermanent. All conditioned things were dukkha or unsatisfactory. And then all things are anatta or not-self. So impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not-self. The five aggregates are this list of five things that we take to be a self. We take it to be solid. This is how we come up with the idea that I'm an art and I'm important. And I matter and they better take me seriously. You know, I'm a Jan and my feelings got hurt. And they were wrong. You know, all of this stuff. Over and over, tumbling forward, creating this sense of self repeatedly. This snowball kind of gathering momentum as it runs downhill. Another teaching, there are many teachings, many of the discourses talk about the five aggregates, and there's an early one, the Buddha's first teaching that he gave to the group of five bhikkhus, the discourse on setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And in that, he's talking about the discourse that, where he talks about the Four Noble Truths. And he's talking about the First Noble Truth. Now, this bhikkhu means a very dedicated practitioner. Now, this bhikkhus is the noble truth of dukkha, of suffering, of stress, of unsatisfactoriness. Now, bhikkhus, this is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Anybody know any of that aging dukkha? Yes. Oh, one person. Okay. All right. Illness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Union with what is displeasing is dukkha. Separation from what is pleasing is dukkha. Anybody know these? Not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. Not to get what one wants is dukkha. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are dukkha. So, all of those definitions of dukkha, what suffering, unsatisfactoriness, misery, stress, any way you want to translate dukkha, all of those can be summed up as, in short, the five aggregates subject to clinging. Wow, so this, we may want to pay attention here. What are these things? And, yeah, okay. So they're not just the main list that the Buddha used to teach. He also often used them to teach about the not-self characteristic. We can see here he's teaching about them being dukkha, and he also taught many times about them being impermanent. So, what are the five aggregates? The first one, I'll say the Pali, but then I'll mostly use the English translations, or I'll try to focus on that. Rupa, which is form or the body. Everything that's known through the five physical senses. In Buddhism, we get a bonus sixth sense, which is the mind and mental objects and that kind of thing. But for purposes of the five aggregates, that is form, the body, known through those five physical senses. Okay. Number two, Vedana. You may have heard this word. If not, you'll hear it more. You may know it as feeling tone. Not feelings like emotions, but feeling like pleasant or unpleasant, or neither unpleasant nor pleasant. The Buddha said that every experience, in every moment, experience is either pleasant or unpleasant or neither. May be accurate, may not be accurate. Worth checking out. Worth checking out. The third, sanya. Usually translated as perception, sometimes as cognition. about that, going into that in a little bit more detail. That is, so Venerable Anālaya on Sanya, on perception. To speak, Sanya, perception or cognition. To speak of a cognition of an object refers to the act of identifying raw sensory data with the help of concepts or labels, right? Such as when one sees a colored object and recognizes it, recognizes it as, oh, that's black, or this is red, or this is a blanket or a tapestry or something. This is a lecture. That's a clock. Yeah, this is the kind of perception that they're talking about, that the Buddha was talking about. I'm not always sure that perception is the greatest translation of that word, but it is that cognition or recognition of things, colors, objects, things like that. As Anālaya continues, Venerable Anālaya continues, cognition to some extent involves the faculty of memory, which furnishes the conceptual labels used for recognition. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah? With me mostly? Yeah? Any burning questions? Any burning questions, feel free to raise your hand. Okay? So that memory, we know something. I know that's a chair. I've seen chairs before. I've sat in them many times. Here's a chair right here. This is a sheet of paper. I know paper, right? I don't have to think about it. This is paper. This is a chair. I just know them. It makes sense to me, right? I see these things on people, these glass objects that some people wear in front of their eyes. Oh, they're glasses. I don't need to think about that at all. I don't need to do any heavy processing of that. Does that make sense? Yeah. We'll do a little more on that later. The fourth aggregate, sankharas. This is a large bucket. This includes volitions, intentions. Some translations of them are mental formations, fabrications, inclinations, intentions. This is an aggregate that conditions the other aggregates. When we were practicing mindfulness in the meditation practice, that was sankharas. That's that intention, mental formations, fabrications. Yeah? If we use that soft mental noting, in, out, or rising, falling, or hearing, any soft mental note that we're making, that's not mindfulness. That is the faculty of perception in the service of mindfulness. So we're using perception all the time. Not good, not bad, on its own. Okay. How do we work with them? Well, one of the things that the Buddha taught repeatedly over and over is to see the aggregate, such is form, such its arising, such its passing away. In other words, the instruction is to see impermanence. Stay with it until we see that it ends, or that it has a beginning and an ending. And as we do that over time, that starts to kind of build up some strength there. So now I'll go into them in a little bit more depth. This next little bit is from the book Emptiness by Guy Armstrong, one of the teachers at Spirit Rock. He's a really wonderful teacher, and I find him very accessible, and he explains things in a really easy-to-understand way. He says, the Buddha often used the five aggregates to show how he identifies a self, plus how to get ourselves out of that predicament. So who owns the aggregates? No one. They arise due to causes and conditions. What we call a being or self is just a collection of parts, aggregates, put together in a certain way for a moment. There is no ongoing entity that is the center or essence of the collection. Right? Now, it may take a while for us to get this. And typically with the Dharma, we have to hear things over and over many times, and then we'll start to, it starts to make sense to us more. So the five aggregates, they make up the subjective experience. They're impermanent, and they're mostly beyond our control. And they work together to create this sense of I am, or me, or mine, any of those kinds of things. Over time, as we start to repeatedly see them and see how they come into existence and pass away, and really start to see their impersonal nature, they're really impersonal, they start to lose their luster a bit. But this can take quite a bit of time. They're quite seductive, and we have a ton of conditioning about taking them to be true and lasting, and that kind of thing. We had an encyclopedia when I was a kid, and in the B encyclopedia, you all get what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. On the body, it had these plastic sheets, mm-hmm. and you could, you know, fold them all over, and then there would be like nothing there. There was the skeleton there on the background, and then you flip the next one over, and it shows the. I don't know what showed, the circulatory system or the organs, or at any rate, you flip these things over, the circulatory system and the all the different systems, and last the muscles and then the skin on top last. And there's some similarity to that in this, that we are compounding our experience. We're taking all of these experiences that are happening on this moment-to-moment level, and we add them together to create this collage that we take to be me. The Buddha actually never said that there wasn't a self. And he never said that there was a self. He was asked by someone once, and in the discourses, if you ask something three times... Mm-hmm. Sometimes the Buddha would not answer the first time a question was answered, and then wouldn't answer the second time a question was answered. But on the third time, he would answer it. Sometimes with a caveat, you know, be clear about what you're taking this to mean. But so he was asked one time if a self exists, and he, after the third time, he didn't answer either. So the person got bored, thought the Buddha doesn't know anything, and walked away. And somebody asked him, why didn't you answer him? And he said, because if I told them that there is a self, he would think that there's something eternal, something lasting, right? Some lasting me. And if I said there's not, then they're going to take him to be a nihilist. You know, somebody who says that there's no such thing, nothing matters, you know. Which were two of the big, all the different spiritual schools at the time really kind of fell into those two camps. So it was kind of his not answering was his way of saying, I'm not aligning myself with one camp or the other. So it's not necessary or possible, for that matter, to get rid of the five aggregates. There's nothing wrong with the aggregates. It's not the aggregates that are problematic. It's that clinging part, right? The fact that we take them so seriously, right? The Buddha was a fully functioning human being after he became fully awakened, after he became the Buddha. So he still had five aggregates. He had five aggregates. Every moment he had all five. What he did not have is any clinging to them. He was not creating any sense of a lasting self or any sense of permanence. He also did not have to lose anything, right? He knew who he was, other people knew he was. They referred to him as the Buddha or the Blessed One or these different epithets, these different names that he had. But he knew when people used that name, he knew they were talking to him. He had no confusion about that. He had points of view of things. His view, of course, was right view, which makes it a little easier. You tend to get into fewer problems that way. But so he didn't. He didn't have to wipe anything out. I think sometimes when we hear not self, especially early in the practice, we think, "What do I have to get rid of?" Nothing. Nothing. It's okay. Let it fall away. See the house of cards for what it is. So there was this story of this Greek king, King Menander, who in the text is called King Melinda. That was his name got translated into Pali, and this was sometime after the Buddha. But King Melinda came to India, or came across this monk. I don't know if the monk was out traveling or King Melinda was, but he met this monk, Nagasena. Nagasena, who I believe was a fully awakened monk. And the king goes and travels to this hermitage where Nagasena is staying, and he asks him some questions. And one of his first questions on the nature of the self and personal identity. And he told the king, he said, look, Nagasena was his name, but Nagasena is only a designation. No permanent individual Nagasena exists. There's nothing to be found there. And the king is like, what? You sure about that? He's like, so then who's wearing those robes? Who's taking this food that I offered? You know, if there's no Nagasena, then who's earning the merit or the demerit? Who causes the karma? If what you say is true, then someone could kill you and there would be no murder. Nagasena would be nothing but a sound, vanishing sound. So Nagasena asked the king, how did you arrive at the hermitage today? On foot or by horseback? And the king says, I came in a chariot. Nagasena says, so what's the chariot? Is it the wheels? Are the wheels the chariot? What about the axle? Is the axle the chariot? How about the reins? What about the seat? Is the seat the chariot? What about the pole, the standing pole there? Is that the chariot? What is the chariot there? And the king answered no to each question. And Nagasena said, then there is no chariot. The king had to admit he had been God there. It was a powerful teaching for the king. And he acknowledged, the king saw, that this designation of chariot, it's a concept. It's a useful concept. But it depends on these constituent parts, these things that come together, that come together due to causes and conditions, and that will also pass away in the same way. And he said, just so, Nagasena said, just so, Nagasena is a designation of something conceptual. When the constituent parts are present, we call it a chariot. When the five aggregates are present, we call it a being. Yeah. So with the chariot, you know, at what point, a chariot or a car, if we're disassembling a car, at what point is it no longer a car? You know, if we take out one headlight, is it no longer a car? The front bumper, the tires, you know. So the self is a concept. It's a useful concept, but it is just a concept. We take this body to be permanent over and over, and yet it's constantly changing. I found this list online of the different cells of the body and how long they last before they're replaced, because almost all the cells in the body are replaced over and over. It's this we're continually being remade over and over. Small intestine epithelium last 2 to 4 days. Blood neutrophils, 1 to 5 days. Stomach cells, 2 to 9 days. White blood cells, the eosinophils, 2 to 5 days. Cells in the cervix last 6 days. The alveoli, in the lungs, which are the cells where the oxygen from the air is transmitted into the red blood cells, they are replaced every 8 days. About every 8 days. Taste buds, about every 10 days. Platelets, 10 days. The trachea, every 1 to 2 months. Sperm cells, about every 2 months. Some of the bone cells, depending on the type of cells, anywhere from 2 weeks to a few months. Red blood cells, a few months, maybe 4 months. Some fat cells, 8 years. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Some of you may argue with that time frame. Okay. Yeah. But they're all being replaced over and over, constantly. So, which cells of those are you? Which ones are you? Is it the ones that die off? When do the ones that die off and slough off and get passed through the bladder or the colon, when do those stop being you? When do the new ones start being you? We don't usually look in the toilet bowl and say, "Oh, I miss you, come back." Yeah. Yeah. So I read this in the National Geographic. Your body is a microbial melting pot, home to trillions of bacteria that help keep you healthy and regular. And for decades, scientists have shown their importance with this alluring factoid. The microbes in your body outnumber your own cells 10 to 1. But a new estimate indicates that, as far as cell counts are concerned, it may well be a tie, or close to it. In a new study posted at a publication on this website, scientists at the Weizmann Institute of Sciences, Ron Milo, find that the average human male is made of 30 trillion human cells and contains about 40 trillion bacteria and other cells, most of which reside in the digestive tract. Okay, in other words, your body's cell count is regularly poised to overtake the bacteria, and sometimes it does, depending on how recently you rid yourself of a few trillion via a bowel movement. So, at best, it's about 1 to 1. These bacteria are extremely crucial to our well-being. Science is just starting to figure out how important they are to the immune system, how they are the immune system. Fundamentally a part of the immune system they are. So, at best, we're only half human. Wow, that's a little sobering. Think about that the next time you use that antibacterial soap. You really want to say goodbye to more of these cells that make up this community? We are really a community. You know? Another quote from Guy's book on emptiness. We may feel a lot of pride in our body if others consider it attractive, or we may feel shame if they don't. We may wish that the body were taller or shorter, darker or fairer, lighter boned or broader in the shoulders, but none of that was ever up to us. I didn't even get a vote. The body was birthed and lives its own physical life according to its own physical laws. The basic body we have was never under our control. Of course, its appearance has been influenced by our choices in diet, exercise, and healthcare. But these variations are minor compared to what we were given. Quite something, yeah? The body really is not. We might say it's ours, but we certainly don't control it much, yeah? Okay. Okay, on to number two. Aggregate number two. Feeling tone, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. Is it a mental factor? Is it a physical factor? Is it an inherent part of the object? Any thoughts? Mary?
For me, in my experience, it's all of the above. Mm. It's all of the above, and so it's like a sound could be pleasant if you're thinking it's the ocean, and then if you realize it's the sound of traffic, then it becomes unpleasant, but it's the same sound.
So there's no right. So it's not inherent to the object at all. Yeah. It is said to be a mental factor. It does arise in conjunction with or very soon after a physical factor. You know, maybe in the very next moment, or maybe it arises in tandem with it. I'm not certain about that. I encourage you to pay close attention in your practice to see what's true. I've told a story in here a few times of being in Burma. There were rats that lived in the attic of the little hut that I lived in up in the forest, and they used to really irritate me. I would hear them squeaking and I would get really agitated and irritated. And then a monk friend another Westerner, had rats as pets. And he saw these rats and he said, "Oh, that's a black rat." I'm like, "No, it's not. That's kind of a mottled brown." He's like, "No, it's the species. The species is black rat." And he was telling me all about them as we were doing this walk one day. And they became, all of a sudden, he's like, "Oh, when they're squeaking, that means they're playing with each other." I had a rat as a pet. It was super playful. When I first brought it home, my wife was quite angry with me, but she came to appreciate it over time. Over time, she came to love it. They live about 2 years. All of a sudden, with all of this information, it became more real to me, and my sense of compassion arose. And really, from that point forward, when I would be in my kuti, in my hut, and I would hear the squeaking of the rats, I would get happy. So, absolutely, completely, feeling tone is not inherent in the object. It could be shared. It could be culturally shared by a large number of people. But in terms of freedom, very helpful to see for yourselves times when certain things, something, a sound may be pleasant if you think it's one thing and you think it's something else, it becomes unpleasant. Or to see the changing, how you may know what it is, but you see that changing nature of it. Very helpful for that. Vedana, feeling tone, is conditioned. It's totally conditioned based on history, culture. They had this thing that we would get on alms round when I was a monk. One of the monks told me it was called bitter gourd. And I don't like the bitter taste that much. And it was very bitter. Just really unpleasant. I couldn't stand it, you know. Now, a lot of people didn't like it. But the Burmese? Well, I'll take a little extra of the bitter gourd. I love that bitter gourd. Or many of them did. You know, it's totally, we're conditioned. Likes and dislikes are conditioned based on culture, family, our set of experiences that we go through. And why that feeling tone is so important, as many of you know, it's the launching point for going into craving. Right? Pleasant experience, we get it, we want to hold on to it, we want it to stay, we want it to become bigger. The unpleasant, we want it to shrink, we want it to get smaller. We want it to go away completely and never come back. We, if it's neither, We want it to, we don't want to pay attention to it. We space out. We get deluded. We go into boredom. Whatever that is. Can be very helpful and very useful in our practice. And many, many people in this room have gotten there where you've started to see the difference between pleasant feeling tone and going into greed or desire. Going into grasping. Yeah? And how freeing that is. Or unpleasant experience and not going into aversion. I remember when I started to see that on retreat, it was really fascinating. So we can stop that chain there. So, okay. A little more on perception. The faculty of cognition or recognition. We do this all the time, and it happens pretty effortlessly. We hear a sound, and it registers with us in some way. Now, if you're a birder, you may know that is Nuttall's woodpecker. If you're somebody else, you know it's a clacking sound. Something like that. Right? But we know a sound. We hear it, and we hear cars going by. We don't have to think car, car, car. We just know it. We don't have to do it. Makes no effort. You're hearing my voice and the words that I'm saying. They make, you're able to distinguish separate words in there in what I'm saying. We just take in what I'm saying. You don't have to make any effort to discern in what I'm saying and then run those through the catalog to figure out what they are. Right? We know those. It goes through, happens for us quite easily. Right? If you're not an English speaker, there would be cognition of sound, but there would be perception of sound, but there wouldn't be perception of what those words meant. Right? So perception happens. There's perception that there's the hearing of the sound, there's the understanding of that word, there's putting those words together to form a sentence, all that kind of thing. Think of this stream of perception flowing on. Does that make some sense? Yeah, nods? Nos? Yes, nos? There was this story in an Oliver Sacks book of the person who lost their sight when they were an infant, very young, and then had surgery later to have their sight restored. And when the surgery was done, this person was aghast. It was this really kind of nightmarish blur of colors and shapes and all this stuff. It made no sense to them. Why? Because they missed out on all of that cultural and other learning that we do about what things are and people are and what the world is out there. Yeah? We have misperceptions regularly. I was sweeping one time, and then I noticed there was a little dust bunny off to the side, and I went to sweep up that dust bunny, but before I went over to sweep it up, it moved. Oh, it's a spider. Oh, okay. I got this, my wife, several years has gotten me has made a donation to Spirit Rock in my name, and then wants Spirit Rock to send a card so that I'll get this and see the acknowledgement from them. And so they send this beautiful card. Quite beautiful. And has this writing on the inside. A generous gift has been made to Spirit Rock Meditation Center in honor of Art Jolly. In honor of his life lived in thoughtfulness, grace, and dignity. And a legacy of intelligence left in his passing. on December 20, 2016. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Who knew? So, the person who sent this card either had a misperception of what my wife was looking for, or a misperception of what the card said, or a moment of delusion and realized, we don't have any other card, here we go. I'll use this one. You know, something like that.
Or a great sense of humor.
Or a great sense of humor, exactly. Yeah, I've used this in a couple of Dharma talks so far. This thing has some mileage to it, yeah. One other story of misperception. Many years ago, when I was still single, went to a speed dating event. Anybody heard of speed dating? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So there's like two circles, and you know, you have like 10 minutes or 5 minutes or something like that, and then they ring a bell, and you rotate a person or two people, and then so on and so forth. So you meet a lot of people a short period of time. I think the idea is you meet people and hopefully it gets you out of your head a little bit and that kind of thing and reduces the anxiety at some point. And, you know, meet somebody. Okay. So I had signed up for this speed dating thing at the Unitarian Church in San Francisco, and it was on a Sunday evening, and I went into the room and people were pretty quiet there. It seemed like a different crowd than I had seen at some of these things. But, you know, I noticed people were taking their shoes off as they walked in. I was like, oh, okay, you know, I can do that. That makes me feel a little more comfortable, feel my feet on the floor, and reminds me of Dharma practice. And I start chatting with a woman near me just a little bit. She seems hesitant to talk, and, all right, you know, we can wait for the event to begin. There's no problem. And after about 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, I realize that I am in Eugene Cash's San Francisco Insight Meditation Group. And that the speed dating group is meeting in another room down the hall. So when we have misperception, we think perception is solid and we think that it's accurate. We take it to be accurate. We take it as if there's some objectivity to it, and there's not. So really important to start to, really helpful to start to poke holes in that. You know, so that we start to see what's true and what's not. You know, I think they had probably a better time at Eugene's group. Probably should have stayed there. The fourth aggregate, sankharas, mental formations, intentions, fabrications. This is, I'm going to share some notes fairly quickly from a talk by Stephen Batchelor. This fourth aggregate, sankharas, they fall into three categories. Mental formations or volitions of body, of speech, and of mind. Right? Think of all the wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind. All the unwholesome actions of body, of speech, and of mind. All of these are in that fourth aggregate. Okay? Thoughts, moods, emotions are in there. Mindfulness, even right mindfulness. Compassion, equanimity, joy, gratitude, concentration. These are all parts of this fourth aggregate. Greed, aversion, sloth and torpor, all of the five aggregates, five hindrances are in there. The most hateful actions of the world's greatest despots. the most wonderful actions of the world's greatest spiritual leaders and people of greatest kindness and compassion. All of these are the fourth aggregate. So this is a very large bucket with a lot going on there. Stephen Batchelor on the Sankaras, he says this is where ethics comes from. We assume a perspective toward the world, and this conditions how we act in response to it. And that this word is active, it's probably closer to a verb than a noun. Maybe more like, as opposed to mental formations, maybe mental formings. Formation would be something that is already done, already happened. And this word is a little different from that. This is more active. So some of these formations, the American dream, you can be whatever you want. Anyone can be whatever they want in this country. You just have to try hard enough. Yeah? Right. That the sense that the U.S. is a meritocracy, you know. That's a sankhara. It's a mental formation, one with a lot of power. Yeah? We use that to justify certain people having tons of certain things and other people having nothing or having very little. Yeah? Well, it can be a lot of blame based on that one. People have to, are expected to conform to certain norms. Right? Certain privileges around certain things become the standard, well, without us really even being clear about how that happened. You know, norms around skin color and that becoming the norm, and or around privilege, around male privilege or straight privilege or gender conformity privilege or able-bodied privilege or healthy-bodied privilege or young-bodied privilege. Which probably most of us realized after we got older than that. So, consciousness, the fifth aggregate, is that quality of knowing that arises at the senses, and this one at all six senses. So, it's the knowing that arises at the senses. You're hearing my voice. There's hearing and there's the knowing of that. We don't need to get any woo-woo. It's just, it's right there. We can't separate it, but it is, there has to be consciousness there. There has to be ear consciousness to hear the words. There has to be mind consciousness to put those words together into something that, that makes sense. Yeah? So just that bare level of knowing. So, this was a very quick overview of the five aggregates. It may be the first time you've heard of them, or many times. Either way, I hope it may offer you some sense. Oh, I have one more cartoon. I just want to encourage you that you get to take these and or whatever. You don't get to, you know, we get a talk, if we come here regularly, you get a talk every Sunday, or as many Sundays as you come, right? We get exposed to something else, and we can continue to work with that thing for some time. I know many of you do this quite regularly, but I just want to encourage that you get to continue to work with the aggregates if this is something that you have interest in. And a cartoon before I hand it over, before we move toward our closing metta. There's two, you know, those wheels that the rodents run on. There's one rat on each wheel. The first rat is running, scampering on its wheel along, just as we've seen so many times. The second one, the wheel is at a stop, and the rat is just sitting on the edge of the wheel. And it's saying to the first rat, I had an epiphany. Yeah? So, this this is the truth of waking up to and letting go of that clinging to the five aggregates. Just like that second rat. You can have rats for your inspiration too, mm-hmm. if you so choose. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.